This week, we continue in our series on the Song of Songs and what it means to be loved by God. I don't think I ever asked for permission. Instead, I think I just sort of made my own plans and assumed that everything would be fine. We arranged a 6 o'clock pickup, 6:45 dinner reservation to eat, and then after eating for about an hour and a half or so, we would make our way over to Winter Formal. It was this time of the year, about 16 years ago, my freshman year of high school, and I just decided that I was going to take a date and go to this dance, even though I never asked my parents if I could. And I figured, well, I didn't have to because I had a little bit of money left over, $50, I think, from the burnt CDs I was selling. So I could afford it. My friends and I arranged a limo. Wasn't that much either. It's Louisiana, y'all. And in typical teenage Elijah fashion, I got ready. I put on my chocolate brown suit, my burnt orange tie, my navy shirt, and sprayed a little bit of my dad's cologne on. And I was out the door before my parents could even notice. They were on a grocery run. I was sure it wouldn't have been a big deal, I told myself. We probably talked about it, right? I mentioned it to them. So the night went on, everything was good, the homies were lit, it was fun. That is, until it was time to go home. And I realized the limo wasn't sticking around to take us home, and each of my friends had slipped away before I got a chance to ride with them. So I had to make an awkward call to my parents. I borrowed an acquaintance's phone, and immediately my dad picked up. Elijah, where are you? We've been looking for you all day. Oh, for real? I didn't tell you I was at the school dance. No, you didn't tell us. Well, I'm there. Could you come pick me up downtown? Sure. My dad came through, put the phone down, and picked me up. And I thought everything was going to be okay. I got in the car. We drove slowly away. Didn't come up. And then as we got ready to pull into the neighborhood, he turned to me and said, you know, you never really asked our permission to go. Really? How do we know that you were going to be safe? How did we know that you didn't have sex tonight? How do we know that everything was going to be okay? I know, I called my dad Papa. I know, Papa, I'm sorry. I just didn't think that you would think it was important or for me to say what I was doing. I just didn't think you wanted to know about this part of my life, so I didn't want to get into all of it with you. But I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And my dad then said these words that surprised me. He said, Elijah, you know, today, you need our approval to do these sorts of things. You need our approval today. But we don't want to just give arbitrary approval. We want to know as much of your life as possible. Right now, we are responsible for you, and our job is to help you make the best choices. We can't do that if you hide your life, if you act as though you're the only one affected by your choices. We can't do that if we don't know where you are and what you're up to and who you're with. So we need to know. We want to know. For you, for us, for our peace of mind. And you know, there'll be a time when you won't need our approval anymore, where you'll be fully responsible for your own choices, where you won't really need to ask for permission. And I know you can't wait until that day, but our job is to prepare you as best we can for you so that you know how to make good choices today and tomorrow, and especially when you don't have to ask for permission. Those words, that conversation was one conversation with my dad that I will never forget. It gets to the heart of many issues of growing up, of life and of faith and of social life and of early romance and, of course, and of adulting. So it sticks out because it's a formative moment for me. But I'm mindful that even as I tell this story, we have a diverse audience here. Perhaps we have some parents here of teens and preteens who probably really feel for my parents when I snuck out. Perhaps some of you even want me to go as far and say that, look, they really laid down the hammer. They grounded me for a year just so your kid doesn't get the same idea. I get it. And perhaps we have some of our teens who are listening closely here who probably have similar questions that I did when I was a kid. Do my parents really get me? Do they understand me all of my life, my anxieties, the social pressures, the demands of high school, of middle school, of college? Do they understand the cliques and the gangs and the real palpable longing to feel like you want to fit in somewhere? Do they get my desires, my identity, my culture, my heritage? Do they fully know me? Perhaps these are questions that our young adults share, or our single adults share, or all of our adults share. Do people really know me? How do I live my life now that I don't always have to ask for permission anymore? How do I make sense of this chaos, of this whirlwind, of all that's happening in the world? Before we go any further, I affirm all of those reactions and attitudes and relationships towards authority and dating and social life and sex, because in a place like ours, these are complex questions. Does God really care about the interpersonal struggles of my life? Do the people around me really understand all that's going on with me? See, friends, these questions get at the heart of Song of Songs this morning, especially the passage that we have read. To the casual observer and the Orthodox interpreter, Songs of Song is a peculiar text that does not belong in the Bible, much less in our Sunday morning worship for multiple weeks. What does a text dripping in sexual imagery, erotic prose, and vivid descriptions of the body have to do with us, an intergenerational, multicultural, progressive Christian body? In fact, if you think this, many Christians have thought this too. They normally skip over it, and they only read that part, the part that me and Lauren just read at weddings. They skip over everything else that's happening here. Or for others, they say, well, the best way to understand it is allegory, metaphor, simile. God is like a lover. And one commentator remarking on this says that it's funny how everyone is a biblical literalist until it comes to Song of Songs. Then they know how metaphor, simile, allegory works. All right, cool. But we are neither casual observers nor Orthodox interpreters of this text. We put everything in a critical context, and so we must do that to understand what's happening here, to know what's really going on in this text. We must read this text fully aware of where it might take us and what it might have to say. And I think it takes us to the heart of the human experience, to the interior lives of our ancient religious ancestors and the things that they wondered about. In her commentary on this book, Dr. Renita Weems, a womanist biblical scholar, reminds us that this is a unique text. Perhaps it is one text that is in dialogue with Ecclesiastes, which comes right before it. She says if Ecclesiastes is written from a male perspective, from a man who is full of doubt and resignation and has removed himself from the evils of the world, vanity, oh vanity, she argues that this text is written from the ancient female's perspective. with her 56 voices. This is one of the first times in Scripture, and really one of the only times in Scripture, we get the unmediated, unfiltered voice of a woman. She says this is a rare window into the interior life, the private sentiments, the interpersonal discourse, an intimate conversation of our ancient ancestors. She says that we're usually used to reading the text through a liberationist lens that focuses on the external systems and structures that we're up against. She says that reading this is much more about the internal systems, attitudes within us. And she pushes us to pay attention to what's happening inside of us, what's going on with us. She pushes us to ask, how are you doing? And what's going on with you? How are you doing? And what's going on with you? What are those intimate thoughts? What are those private conversations you're having with yourself, or having with your lover, or having with your family? What's happening to you? Are you and your partner constantly fighting? Are you struggling? Are you feeling like you have to show face because of your job, your role, where you are in your social life? Are your real thoughts hidden deep beneath the surface? There's no shame in how you answer any of this. And perhaps this is one of the points of this text. See, to really understand Song of Songs, was to really understand that this is a text about our inmost desires and thoughts and feelings. And she gives us permission. She places her thoughts before all of us so that we too have the freedom to go inside of ourselves. She sees a young woman, perhaps in her late teens or early 20s, who loves someone, presumably a young man, but we do not know for sure. All we know is that the content of their love transgresses some boundaries, perhaps social and racial, economic and cultural. Perhaps he is rich and she is poor, vice versa. Perhaps she is black and he is white. Perhaps her family has already chosen a future for her that she wishes to struggle against. Perhaps society has already chosen a model of womanhood for her that she wishes to dismantle. Chaste, obedient, feminine, hetero, cis. Perhaps she's rebelling against that. We cannot know what the true issue is, but we know that she feels something deep in her core, in her body, something for her lover. Her desires are forbidden, and so she takes action. She risks for the purposes of love. She is forbidden from what she wants emotionally, physically, materially, sexually. And so she acts, and she cannot, and we cannot overlook this part, her acts, her desires, her sexuality. In a world where church and society police the sexuality of all people, and especially women, we cannot do the same in our interpretation. This text is erotic for eroticism's sake, and the question you got to ask yourself is, why would they put eroticism in the Bible? Perhaps it's because it helps us see that it's important to be open about desire, free about sexuality, understanding about bodies and desires. And she offers in her words a critique against the rigidness of her society and perhaps ours. Lean in and listen to what is happening here. She wants to be with her lover, whomever that person is. She wants to romance them and love them and court them and be intimate with them. She wants her lover close inside of the room. And she finds the courage to say that, but then yet later on in the text we'll see her brothers or sisters, depending on the translation, say that she's too young. She's not really a woman yet. She's physically underdeveloped, emotionally not ready. And so in an effort to protect her from her own unmediated, unfiltered thoughts, they police her. In an effort to protect her from her own unfiltered, unmediated thoughts, they police her. How often do we police people in an effort to protect them? How often do we end up policing our family members, our friends, our lovers in an effort to protect them? How often do we say that what we're doing is for their own good, but maybe in the long run we end up hurting them? We end up perhaps being the ones misguided. We end up keeping them away from what they really do want. How often do we end up, in an effort to protect people, end up policing them? Like, I get it. It's hard. I'm still actively struggling with this right now. And so our protagonist, in all of her boldness and assertion, helps us because she says to them and she says to us, she says to the world, and we record it here in this moment, that she does not need permission to love. She does not need permission to desire, to long to be known, to long to be seen, to long to be intimately connected. And y'all, this is rich and profound and powerful. Don't miss it. But before I talk about its complexity, I have to say it because it puts me in a bind as a preacher and a minister, because not everyone who is saying that they're in love is actually in love. Lots of purported love is actually not love at all. And instead, it's toxic and problematic and immoral and unjust. Violence and abuse and exploitation and gaslighting and other harmful behaviors might contort themselves to falling into this radical notion of permissionless love, but that's not what they are. And it's important to say that love is and ought to be consensual, mutual, between equals, broadly defined, ultimately life-giving. But once we accept these broad parameters, we must accept that what our protagonist is actually saying is pretty good and transgresses much of how we think about love. She says that she does not need permission to love. Not her families, not her societies, not her churches, not even a narrow notion of her gods. But she feels like she can do and love who she wants. Don't miss the power in this, the theological and moral and historical weight it carries. She's saying that based off of her experience, her condition, her social location, she gives herself permission to love, and it does not need to be sanctioned by anyone. That she is free to love him or her. Or them, or they. That she has permission to love, and that she gives herself permission to do this because she feels deep in her heart that this is right. So she gives herself permission to do this. Do you see what she's saying? In a world where a man had to ask her father and uncles and brothers if she would marry her, without consulting her, she takes this into her own hands. It says, I need to be a part of this. She gives herself permission. She radically turns the tables around. And in a real sense, she takes her liberation in her own hands. She's a forerunner to radical lovers. Like enslaved people who love themselves so much and their children so much, who created spouses and families and authorize themselves with the authority to be union, even when the Commonwealth of Virginia would not, and the state of Maryland would not, and the government of the United States would not. These people literally jumped brooms and tied ropes of knots together to sanction their love. They beat the law to recognizing their love. These people ran away from plantations night after night after night to be with their lovers. Some of them ran north and west looking for love immediately after the Civil War. Some of them went to reunite with their families. This is where we get the term family reunions, because people separated from their families during slavery immediately after the separation go looking all over the country for love. But even as I say this, it's easy to get into a framework of where you say, okay, all of that is respectable. Enslaved people finding love, running away for love. beautiful to see them give permission to love. Love for family is good. Love in marriage is good. Love in children is good. And so even in this progressive framework, we can still be limiting. We can still celebrate only gay and lesbian and trans people whose love looks like hetero people's love. What about the love that seems less respectable and less understood and even more forbidden? What about the types of people who refuse to be boxed, gendered, binaried? What about the people who make a case for themselves, for their life, for their freedom, for their happiness, purely on the grounds of their humanity? For the thug who doesn't look approachable, for the stud who will not change, for the trans person who you can't quite figure out, for the immigrant who isn't a model student, for the undocumented youth who has gotten into a lot of trouble? What about those people who are self-emancipating, giving themselves permission and freedom to be and to live and to be who they are? CCC, when I think about what's most powerful in this text, what's most beautiful about this text is that these are people led by our seeking, our love-seeking protagonists who show us how to actually be more, who show us the way to live, who say that to the complex questions of life, one cannot seek permission from elsewhere, but one must seek permission from yourself. I know I'm saying something here. One must seek permission from yourself. One must look to your own conscience, to your own soul, to your own heart. One must validate yourself, affirm yourself, give yourself permission to love, to be free, to be liberated, to be okay with who you are and how you are. To be okay with who you are and how you are. To be okay with who you are and how you are. For the society will rarely fully affirm you. Rarely fully affirm. So your task as a moral being is to look to your own conscience, your own soul, your own heart, and affirm who you are. Be okay with who you are. See, as much as this text is about love, it's about more than love. It's about making the case for freedom of conscience. Making the case for freedom of conscience. And what she says is that she's not idealist about it. She knows that this is a risky task. She knows and she warns against the sort of the hopeless romanticism that the love that she has for her lover will conquer everything. In the end, it does not. Her love is real, but it is tested. And she knows that it may not survive. It might not survive through the pervasive cultural norms, or through the toxic family beliefs, or through the unhelpful opinion of others, or through even the lover's own quirks and vices and destructive habits, that the love may not actually survive. But yet she believes that it is worth it to take this risk for love. What do you think about? It's about giving yourself permission to love, to live, to be, that you have a freedom of conscience in all things, including love. And to follow that conscience is to risk. See, that is part of her message to us today. She has the freedom to love. She takes the freedom, love. But she lives in a world that has not yet caught up with her. And so there's despair there. But she takes the freedom to love anyways, knowing the risk, knowing the potential for failure, knowing that when she pursues love and her lover, she pursues God, for God is love. Right? And God and herself give permission to love. May we take the permission to love that we already have.